how are we going to work this Israeli-Palestinian conflict from within the confines of the nation-state system and our mindset in this day and age that we need to be ruled over by some political authority, you're not going to have a happy solution. The fact that they are so wedded in our minds that we can't imagine law without government is actually to our detriment. Again, there are the idiots with the straw man that come in and say, oh, it'll just be people killing and raping and going on a pillaging spree. And if you go back far enough, people literally were told to worship the pharaoh or worship the emperor as if that was a literal god on earth. If you were going to try to tell people that Biden is a literal god on earth, and that is why he has the right to rule over you, you would be rightly laughed off the face of the planet. You can cite other passages that show, hey, maybe God was an anarchist. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about these things. They're foundationally incredibly important.
So thank you, James, for coming on my podcast again. Last interview, we talked about some general various topics, but in this one, I want to talk about the philosophical aspects of anarchism, of human freedom and morality. So my first question is, people view the Western democratic system of government as the greatest thing to ever be invented because now we the people get to decide who rules over us through elections. Why is Donald Trump, Kamala Harris, RFK Jr. not a short-term solution for people's problems? And why is voting for people in a democracy always wrong, illogical, illegitimate, or against human freedom?
Excellent. Well, you got us several hours. Here's my short answer to that. Maybe in a sense, maybe people who say that democracy is the greatest thing that we have for running society, maybe they are right in this sense, in that if your goal is to rule over humanity in the most efficient way possible, I like to think of it as iterations of the Matrix for people who might remember that movie, or maybe you don't remember that movie, but essentially we're all living in a computer simulation of the year 1999 in Los Angeles. We're actually strapped into pods, you know, getting this all fed to us through a computer input into our brains. But one of the points of the Matrix trilogy was that this isn't the first iteration of that Matrix that the computers tried to enslave humanity. No, first of all, they tried to give humanity some sort of perfect nirvana utopia where they could have anything they want. But people would pull themselves out of the Matrix because they just didn't believe it. It wasn't believable. So they kept refining and rebooting the Matrix and making it more and more realistic until you get the world as we know it. And people will gladly keep themselves strapped into that Matrix for their entire lives because it contains enough rewards and incentive and etc. So I think of the iterations of people trying to control humanity in a similar manner. There have been many iterations of this over the years. And if you go back far enough, people literally were told to worship the pharaoh or worship the emperor as if that was a literal god on earth. And that is the reason why this person and his family had the right to rule over you. And well, I don't know whether or not I can't go back and interview someone from a couple thousand years ago and ask them if they truly believe that or if they just went along with it. But at any rate, it was the justification that was given at that time. That obviously evolved eventually. Well, really, is this actually God? Well, no. Okay, it's God appointing this family. It's a divine right to rule, or it's the mandate of heaven. And all of this type of chicanery nonsense, eventually that started to fade away as obviously things develop and the Enlightenment and all of this. We don't need that hocus pocus anymore. No. How best to control humanity after the age of imperial monarchs and others? Well, how about this? How about it's not God appointing someone to rule over you? It is you appointing someone to rule over you. So this is the next reboot of the Matrix in which you get a stake in this. And so it's your choice who you get to get ruled over by. Yay, isn't that great? And it certainly is a more efficient and effective way of getting people to stay in that Matrix. If you were going to try to tell people that Biden is a literal god on earth, and that is why he has the right to rule over you, you would be rightly laughed off the face of the planet. But if you say, no, he's the expression of the will of the people and 50% plus one of the population cast a vote for him, many, many people will go along with that. as long as they believe that 50% plus one of the population actually voted for him. And that isn't it interesting that in 2020, that became the focal central point of the whole discussion and debate about the legitimacy of the Biden presidency, is whether or not actually 50% plus one of the population or the Electoral College or what have you actually did vote for him. No, there's ballot fraud and all of this. So people get it obsessed with how many people actually cast a ballot for this or that candidate, and it all becomes about that. So that is the way that we are ruled over in this system. We participate in that process, and we feel like we have a part in it, and thus we have ownership, as it were, of this. Now, as to the latter part of the question about the legitimacy of this voting process, or even the morality of this voting process, it certainly should. Having put it in that context, it should, for any critically thinking human being, that should make you think, well, what is it about 50% plus one of the population putting their piece of paper in this magic box or touching a screen these days? What is it about that somehow legitimizes this thing called government, that suddenly has this right to rule over this arbitrarily defined geographical area that has just been claimed as the domain of this thing called government? And why does that process work? What is this process of legitimation? What if we came up with some other way of imagining how this or that geographical boundaries could be ruled over? And then you have to start questioning, well, okay, what about the 50% minus one of the population who did not vote for this candidate or the other candidate? What makes them beholden to the whims and dictates of that person who presumes to be ruling over 50% plus one of the population? You do not consent. What if you do not consent to this process at all? What if you don't even cast a vote? What if you're not voting in this process, and so you have absolutely no stake in it? Why does this government have the right to rule over you and set these laws and other things for you? And thus, by participating in the process and casting a vote for whatever candidate you cast a vote for, are you thus legitimizing that system and saying, yes, absolutely, whoever gets 50% plus one of these votes is the rightful ruler of this geographical area and can rule over me and everyone else? And what gives you the right to decide who rules over everyone else? These are all questions that, at the very least, I certainly have my own answers to them, but at the very least, I think any critically thinking human being should be asking when it comes to these matters.
I agree. And these people that are voting, they kind of want to have control over other people and tell them what to do through the laws or through what their candidate is saying. So, and also, if you think of the Jewish people in Nazi Germany, like, are they morally obliged to believe the laws and that's the right thing? And if they don't follow the law, they're like bad, or they deserve the punishment that the law says. So, I mean, you could just question it. I would like people to question it at its core, you know, at its philosophical, you know, core of what they're trying to tell you.
Well, perhaps we can start by making a distinction between law and government, because those two things do not have to go together. And the fact that they are so wedded in our minds that we can't imagine law without government is actually to our detriment, because a lot of people will say, okay, anarchy, get rid of government. That'll just be chaos, because you need laws. I mean, what? You're just murder, rape, theft, whatever. It's full crime spree, whatever people want to do. Well, no, not necessarily. How could you have laws without government? Well, how did this thing used to work way back in the day? For example, back several centuries ago, back in somewhere like England, where they had common law, which is a series, the concept of, rather than, because here's another distinction that we need to make. In our vocabulary, in the current day and age, we think of law as something that is written down by one of these magical lawgivers in the holy seat of power in government. And they write this down, and then that becomes a law that then becomes enforced by the enforcers of this state. But that is not necessarily the definition of law. That is a definition of a type of law. But as opposed to that, contradistinction to that, there is the concept of common law, which is a evolving, not written down, series of rules and norms of a given locality that have been gaveled down over the course of years, decades, generations, that forms a body of law that is understood to pertain in a certain community. And that concept of law does not require some ruler to come down with an iron fist and say, okay, now you cannot murder because I have written it on this piece of paper. No, we understand that you cannot murder because that is the way that this community functions and has functioned for generations back into time immemorial. That is the kind of distinction we have to say. To say no government is not to say no concept of law, no way of enforcing some sort of norms or standards in a community. No. But it's to say that we do not need a ruler to write it down on a piece of paper in order for it to become law.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to mention other ways, like the people who mention natural law, natural rights, or the Declaration stuff. But also, I can understand why some people will say, oh, I'm an atheist, what the hell is that? So, I mean, it's just common sense type stuff, or looking at the past, looking at human actions, or just seeing what works. Obviously, you could tell if a society is good or bad based on what they're allowing, not allowing, or promoting. I think people just have that natural good. But my next question, actually, I just had a quick comment that I wrote down. In the most dangerous superstition, Larkin Rose, he says that the government is an elected class, and once they get that power, they automatically have new rights that we the people would not normally have, such as charging taxes. When if I were to do that to somebody, they would say, you're extorting me. Or if I tell them, get a permit, because I'm the authority of this business or this sector. But Mark Passio also says, like, when cops put on their little uniform or their costume, now they have some magical rights to do stuff that when they're off the clock, they cannot do. They can't invade somebody's house. They can't. Well, depends. For drugs, like, let's say for drugs, you can't do that. So yeah, that's just a comment. And then the next question is, why is human authority declared through government illegitimate? And how do people break that belief that they have to follow that, like, let's say a weed law or some jaywalking law? I don't know. Any law that doesn't really make sense. Why are they not morally obligated, why is it not true?
All right. Well, once again, I think, as I was saying before, I think that the distinction that we have to make in our mind is the concept of law as something that is written down and thus must be followed versus something that is a standard of the community in which we live, which we may or may not have our own personal disagreements with, but at any rate, that has been instituted over a process of the development of a body of law over generations. And if we think of laws as something that is written down on a piece of paper by a lawgiver, then that begs the question of the morality, the inherent morality of a law. So something is perfectly fine until that lawgiver writes down, oh, by the way, you shouldn't murder. Oh, now it's wrong, and now we should be beholden to it. Of course not. That on its face is obviously nonsense, and we all understand that, but people kind of forget that, and the concept of law gets elided in their minds. So once again, I would say that in my own conception, it is the body of law that accrues and becomes a standard over a period of time that is law. And that doesn't rely on the concept of natural law, because yes, I certainly do believe there is natural law and natural rights. And for example, the right to life is fundamental, and you cannot take that from me. However, there are absolutely, of course, there are going to be gray areas in all sorts of different things. And well, who was right in this particular instance, given these circumstances? And that is the type of thing that has to be adjudicated. And any given judge can and presumably will be wrong, at least some of the time. We're all humans. We will all make mistakes. We're imperfect. We are all fallible. So it should never rest on one person, one lawgiver, one judge. It should be this process of over time. Oh, this community has adjudicated this in this way for this length of time, and it becomes more and more, the weight of that becomes greater as time goes by. And that's the way I think of it. It's a development and discovery of these laws rather than the writing down and the instantiation of these laws.
Right, yeah. And I mean, ideally, all of our human society will be going to a greater direction, unless you believe, like, oh, humans are dumb, we're all going to blow each other up and be stupid. But I remember when I was in school here in California, they would show us a little video of a bill, and it would just sing, I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill. And then it shows, like, how a bill becomes a law, or try to teach you what laws are.
Right. Let's think about it from that perspective, because in a system like I'm talking about with common law that accrues over time and that it's a discovery process, we are discovering what laws and standards and rules pertain to this or that community. That means that there is no one single person who can come in and change it all and make it all basically rule by decree and by fiat. No. We've determined over the course of generations, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of cases that this is the way that we act. And there will always be some corrupt person or some completely inept person who will come along and rule on the wrong side, deliberately or otherwise. But that particular ruling will not rule against the overwhelming body of law that has accrued over the course of generations. And I think that's an important point. In a status system where law is whatever the lawmaker writes down, then you better believe, all these people who are, yay, Trump, he's going to save us, yay, and he can write whatever presidential directives he wants and do whatever he wants, and then suddenly Biden gets in power. Oh, no, I can't believe that all of these powers that we gave to the person we like have suddenly landed in the lap of the person we don't like. Oh, it's the end of the world, which, of course, makes the voting, the democratic process even more important to the average statist, because it is literally a game for all the marbles. The lawmaker can write down whatever law he wants. So this is the most important thing in the world. Yes, somebody can come in tomorrow and completely change morality. So we better devote all of our time, all of our energy, all of our resources to investing all of everything that we have, our identity itself, into this voting process. I understand from a statist perspective, people who believe that lawmakers literally do write down laws and literally change the moral fabric of the universe with their decrees. I understand why people take that so seriously and get so caught up in it. But I'm just saying, hey, actually, you know what? Let's leave that to the side and let's explore this other concept of law.
Yeah. Okay. And my next question is, well, first a statement. Today is Mexican Independence Day, where Mexicans first declared independence from Spain. Mexico still had an emperor from the Habsburg family until the mid-1800s. So that's like not even 300 years ago. Europe still has many monarchies like King of Spain, Netherlands, Belgium, Norway, Bulgaria, England, Sweden, Denmark, and many other heads of state that are from blood lineages or families. Can you explain how or why some modern royalty is still in charge in some places, and why are they so open about it? You can see the Wikipedia. Are they like proud of it?
Yeah. You know, that's actually a really interesting moment of wonder that people should be taking a look at. Yeah. What is it with these rump royalties that still exist, that obviously they don't really run anything? Why are they still there? Why are they still literally the chief executive of this or that state? It is because what it points to is exactly that problem of legitimation that we were talking about earlier. Because, yes, again, back in the day, it was God appointing rulers or what have you. But these days, no, you're picking your ruler. But the question goes back to what is the state predicated upon? And for a lot of nations around the world, they cannot get to that level where all of this, the actual chief executive of the country, is literally someone who's voted in and out of office every 4 years. That doesn't seem to make sense. No, the person who fundamentally girds the state is literally the person upon which the state rests. Can't just be some political figure that you're voting in and out. No. It has to be something like a king or a queen. Even if literally their only function is to sign, give their assent to bills. It's like, no, what is this? What makes that bill into actual law and thus changing the moral fabric of the universe? It's not some namby-pamby politician that we're throwing in and out of every few years. No, this is serious. We need a royalty for that. And so that literally is why the royalty exists in most places. Now, we could get into the discussion about royal families and, you know, whether they King of England currently truly does own all of this land that is in the crown's name and all of that, and what that represents in terms of wealth and power and all of that.
Australia.
But yeah, Canada. Hey, I'm like Canadian, so I am technically subject to King Charles.
Nice.
No, thank you.
Right. So in my G. Edward Griffin interview, he kept mentioning on collectivism and where individuals' rights must be sacrificed or the person even killed for the good of the society as a whole. So, I mean, I think that's What can you say about collectivism versus individualism and how it applies in our modern governments, like our individual rights taken away and certain people dying?
I think the only way that we can be trained into accepting a collectivist mindset is through a false moral philosophy. And that false moral philosophy rests on utilitarianism or consequentialism. So either what sort of way of running things will be the most beneficial for the most number of people? And when you start making that calculus, then suddenly your individual rights, your unassailable, inviolable, fundamental human rights as you, as an individual, well, they're negotiable. They can be cast out the window. Yeah, okay, I don't want to have to kill you. But if I kill you and save a million people, well, you know, it's a pretty obvious utilitarian equation going on there. You know, it's one person's death is a tragedy, but a million person's death, well, that would be something even worse.
Like nuking Japan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly right. Well, hey, you know, and the funniest thing is that the propaganda that Americans have been fed for the past better part of the century is that was necessary because it would have been a bloody, horrible invasion and many, many people would have died in the actual invasion of the homeland. So it was easier just to nuke them. But actually, the last line of defense these days, the geopolitical realist line of defense is, okay, yeah, it wasn't really. Japan was ready to surrender, unconditional. It was going to happen anyway. It really didn't need to nuke. But what it was really about was a message to Stalin, like, hey, we've got the nuke now. You know, it was really about this geopolitical calculus. So people are, in that sense, are arguing that the utilitarian mindset of literally nuking cities of civilians, of men, women, and children, tens of thousands dying in an instant, hundreds of thousands over time, was worth it because it sent a geopolitical message to a third party that wasn't even part of that nuking equation. That should be one of those things that tickles people's brain if they have any functioning brain cells left. Hey, is that really a moral philosophy that we should be abiding by?
Or how about like right now in Palestine, they're saying, well, I don't even know what their reasoning is. Like these women and children have to die their human shields for the greater good of Israel or democracy or the West.
Exactly right. Yes. Again, utilitarian consequentialist. And I think the consequentialist argument, which is to say, okay, you could respect everyone's individual rights and have all of that, but it would be a much less efficient society. We would have, it wouldn't work that well. But if we rule in this way, it will be much better. The outcomes will be better. I actually don't even believe that consequentialist argument. I believe that respecting individual human freedom will result in the greatest flowering of the human species, that we will be able to reach our potential if we are unfettered by the chains of government. But I know that's a hard sell for people because they can't, again, begin to wrap their minds around how we could possibly function fruitfully without a central controller, literally controlling everything we do, despite the fact that, unbeknownst to us, we don't think about it, but 99.9% of everything we do in our lives is done under anarchy. You do not have, at least at this point, you do not have the government coming in and telling you what clothes to wear today, who to date, what job. You must do this job. This is your life. We have so much freedom in so many aspects of our lives that we don't even think about and wouldn't even think to question. Of course, I chose what to wear today, and I'm not particularly fashionable, so it was probably a bad choice. But I still don't want the government to come in and tell me what to wear. And in the exact same fashion, can we just extend that to the other parts of our lives, which are not negotiable, not subject to this freedom? And what would be the disaster that happens if that does happen? Again, there are the idiots with the straw man that come in and say, oh, it'll just be people killing and raping and going on a pillaging spree, as if I wouldn't care, whatever, you can murder me or whatever, your free will, man, no, whatever you want to do, as if I have no part to play in that or in my own defense, and as if every single person in the world wouldn't be incentivized to have security for themselves and their family. In fact, I think that incentive, it would be even stronger in a society where we don't put that burden on some third party government thing that's going to come along and protect us most of the time. But if they don't, what are you going to do? You can't Police have immunity from prosecution, so you, if they do something wrong, you can't do anything about it. If they fail to protect you, they actually, in the United States, for example, it's been ruled the police don't have a duty to protect you. So if they don't bother to protect you, well, there's nothing you can do about that. What are you going to do? The security is a monopoly game that is played by the dictators who we, presumably in my audience at any rate, most people know are psychopaths who have this desire to rule over you, do not have your best interests in mind. Why are we relying on them for our security and then defending that? That's the only way we could possibly secure ourselves and our family is to give all of that, cede all of that authority for our own protection to some independent, well, not even independent, some completely controlled creature of the psychopaths that are attempting to rule over us. It is, that is insanity. But again, we are like fish. We cannot see the water we're swimming in, and we're in statist land. So of course, everything has to be done through this vehicle called government.
Yeah, like in the Matrix. I don't know the exact quote, but the Matrix is all around you. Like you were born in, and you just don't see it. It's just ideas.
Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know, you can't explain. But you feel it. You felt it your entire life. That there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there. Like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind.
I was going to mention, like, in that aspect of central controllers and, like, who they really are, I was looking into the coerced sterilization and how the World Bank is, like, funding poor countries to basically keep their populations low and how you could even see China. You've probably heard China's two-child policy. They believe they know better than you and the overpopulation and, you know, they just want to kill you.
Yes. Believe it. And for people who don't understand that, I have done a lot of work on that over the years. So look at overpopulation or depopulation or eugenics or other key search terms on CorbettReport.com. I've got lots of reports on that. It is documentable, and we can go into the history of that. And also the sort of moral justifications that the would-be rulers of this system use to enact those policies of, say, forced sterilization or involuntary, unwitting, coerced sterilization through vaccine programs or what have you. Why would that, how could any person possibly justify such a thing? Well, there's an entire ideology of eugenics, which was essentially the replacement for that bygone era philosophy we were talking about where, oh, God has appointed this family to, well, of course, no, that we can't really believe that anymore. No. It's because certain people have genes that make them fit to rule over the dumb masses of people who have the inferior genes. And ultimately, once you accept that eugenics idea, of course, it brings with it the shadow of dysgenics, which is to say, okay, so now we know and we can sort out who are the good genes and the bad genes, because good genes, obviously, are going to be successful. So rich and powerful people deserve to be rich and powerful because they have better genes. And the poor and people struggling to make ends meet, you obviously have bad genes. So, you know, at a certain point, in order to improve the human species, we got to get rid of those people with the bad genes and foster those with the good genes. So basically, it is a license to kill the poor and give everything to the rich. Yeah, what? Who could disagree with that?
Yeah, I mean, there's people who breed dogs and they breed fish. They call it culling. I mean, you have to feed the deformed fish to a freaking monster fish.
Yes, and the worst part, really the worst part about the eugenics philosophy is that it does appeal to that analogy with the animal kingdom, in which we breed certain dogs for certain characteristics, or we breed certain animals so that they have certain characteristics. Why wouldn't we breed humans so they have certain characteristics? And there is a certain level at which that people find that argument persuasive. And of course, everyone imagines in such a scenario, well, of course, if you're picking for the good genes, I would, of course, be picked. And I, you know, my family would be fine, but it would be all these people I don't like. They'd be the ones who'd get culled. Whereas, of course, first of all, it is nothing but a fig leaf for the people who want to rule over you anyway to do exactly what they want to do to you. But hey, they get the added bonus of you, again, buying into it if you accept that fundamental ideology and those fundamental distinctions. As if we can determine what are the good genes and what are the bad genes, and oh, this person is poor, therefore we got to get rid of them. And then suddenly when they come for you, when there is the knock on the door, hey, you know, for the good of society, we got to get rid of you. Surprised Pikachu face. I never thought this would be used against me. We are not animals, and we are not being bred for some certain purpose to be used by some ruler who wants to more efficiently run the human farm. And if that is your conception of society, then you are an enemy of free humanity and an enemy of me.
Yeah, I mean, we have to believe that everybody's, you know, created equal, or at least has equal rights, or... And like, there's already people that in Europe, some Sweden or Norway, they abort their Down syndrome babies like at 90% plus rate. So people already kind of believe that. They're already like stupid people, low IQ people, just abort them, kill them.
I mean, unfortunately, that mindset exists. And I think we need to be the voices in the wilderness, at the very least, calling attention to the moral insanity of such a thing. And also just knocking on the door, just leaving the casual note to people, well, okay, you don't have Down syndrome, or you're not on the bottom rung of the economic ladder, but that doesn't mean they're not coming for you next, because they absolutely are. They, them, those are predatory psychopaths who want to be in complete control of humanity. Do you think they're just going to leave you and your family alone, or you're going to prosper in such a plan? It's ridiculous to think that.
Okay. My next question is, first, Lex Fridman, when discussing Israel and Palestine with Mohammed El Khoury, refers to Mohammed's idea of a world beyond states as, we have to have representation of the people. You have to have laws, leaders, and governing bodies that enact those laws. Probably need to have militaries to protect people. And then he shuts down his vision by saying, we're not in that world. Violence is natural in humans, as well as hunger for power, and then talks about a realistic short-term solution being either the one-state or two-state solution. What would you say to Lex about his mindset? He already knows Michael Malice, the anarchist, but still promotes this idea, and even though he loves to talk about love all the time, what message would you give to people like Lex who have some sway with or power with their large audiences? Or what would you say about his commonly held belief?
Yeah, well, something makes me believe that if he was actually promoting the anarchist philosophy, he probably wouldn't have much sway or emphasis in the controlled mainstream alternative media. But anyway, you know what? The way I would frame that is, when people ask, well, don't you think that Israel has a right to exist? I would say, no, I don't think any state has a right to exist. States do not have rights. No government has a right to exist. What does that even mean? Who are you? What entity are you granting this right to? No, of course, Israel as a state does not have a right to exist. And the real answer is not one state solution or two state solution. It's zero state solution. Now, saying that, I understand, again, the consequentialist moral philosophy, the utilitarian moral philosophy. Well, okay, yes, I get the idea of sometime in the never future, but in the here and now, that's not going to happen, and you can't flip that switch overnight. And actually, I have made this point before, I'll make it here again. If I had the magical switch to simply throw the switch, all governments disappear, and tomorrow morning we are completely living in total anarchist land, where there are no governments, I would not flip that switch, because the process of deconstructing the state has to be a one that evolves, and that is pieces are put in as the statist institution crumbles. It has to be replaced. And that's the vision that you get from philosophers like Samuel Edward Konkin III talking about agorism, where the idea is the agorist revolution is one in which essentially counter institutions are being created and fostered at the community level that start to replace the state, to the point where the statist institutions become superfluous. Why would anyone need that statist institution when we have this one that we've created ourselves and that is already functioning? I'm going to go with this. And that's, I think, the vision of how we get from here to there. So yes, ultimately, I believe, for example, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, again, the ultimate solution absolutely is a zero-state solution. But I understand the idea, well, we're not going to do that tomorrow morning. It's not that we're just going to get rid of all governments and it's going to be completely gone tomorrow morning. It has to be a process. And so, yes, from a practical perspective, we have to think about how we get from here to there. And that's, you know, it's above my pay grade, but it's above any individual human being's pay grade. I think it has to come from collective efforts of many, many people working together. And that's another thing I want to stress. When we talk about individuals, individual rights, individual freedoms, that does not mean that we don't work together in society and we don't work together towards goals that we share. In fact, quite the opposite. What it means is getting rid of the impediments, the third middleman in every interaction that we have as human beings, the government that's hovering over our shoulders, so that we can actually cooperate with each other. As free, sovereign, individual human beings, we can interact on that basis of voluntary cooperation. I agree with you on this point. Let's work together for that. I disagree with you on this point. I'm going to do it this way over here. That is how an order actually arises out of society spontaneously, naturally, from the ground up, rather than some outside power dictating that from the top down. So yes, do I think, you know, one state solution, two state solution, well, how are we going to work this Israeli-Palestinian conflict from within the confines of the nation state system and our mindset in this day and age that we need to be ruled over by some political authority? You're not going to have a happy solution to this conflict. It is not until we get to the zero state solution that we will have something actually that will actually function in the real world.
Right, right. And I think, like you mentioned, we need I would think, more knowledge of why it's illegitimate to have democracy or everything like that, or your basic rights and why they're being disrupted with that. And also, like you mentioned, people would have to decentralize. Basically, from a centralized government that takes care of everything for you, they got to take on some responsibility or find out what people are stuck to with the government, like maybe Medicare or Social Security is what I hear during this election cycle, and maybe decentralize some type of way to care for people's health care if they get in an accident, or help old people when they retire. I mean, I don't know. There's obviously ways to everybody could decentralize and put in their fair share of effort. You mentioned in our last talk that humans need a conscious revolution in order to abandon the belief in the state, positions of power, government, and overall positions of human authority that control and claim authority over other humans. What truths about these democratic roles in our society do people need to be made aware of, like systematically, so that the mass amount of people could understand it, and almost like a simple list of stuff about it?
I suppose if I had the simple list, or if I had it distilled down to the simple list, I'd simply deliver that list and then hang up my microphone and retire. I'm not sure it's that easy. It's part of an ongoing deprogramming that is happening at the same time as an ongoing concerted propaganda effort is trying to program the population. And unfortunately, given the fact that we are, from the very earliest age, stuck into, generally speaking, government institutions of education indoctrination, then there are statists being manufactured every single day of every single year, and more coming online. So how do you get people out of that? Again, I don't think it's a simple 1, 2, 3 step process, but there can be different ways for different peoples. I think one of the things that finally got me to start thinking along these lines, after having been thoroughly indoctrinated in the same indoctrination system as everyone else and coming out as a statist, as everyone does, one of the things that got me really fundamentally questioning this for me personally was, the really first penny to drop for me was, oh, hey, 9/11 was absolutely not what they told us it was. They are absolutely lying through their teeth about that. And there is mountains of evidence of government complicity in whatever happened on the morning of September 11th. That's crazy. And I can't fit that into my framework of the world and how that works. And what does this mean? And that started sending me tumbling down the rabbit hole. Oh, wait, money itself is being created out of thin air by these central banks at interest, loaned back to the central banks and the banks themselves. And what is going on? What, you know, how does this function? And it was that exploration of how power actually functions in society, not the fairy tales that were given in school, but how does power actually function, that led me to start questioning and start discovering, for example, the psychopathy that defines the political class. And why? Why is it that psychopaths are so drawn like moths to the flame of that seat of power in government? Oh, it's because it's a seat of central seat of power and control over which one person can have a vast effect in completely changing the face of human history. Oh, I get why a psychopath would be interested in such a thing. So what is the ultimate way to combat that? Just to vote harder and make sure that a good person gets into that seat of power? Oh, no. You know, maybe we can look at a different analogy here. Oh, like Lord of the Rings, there's nothing you can do with the ring. No one can resist the ring. You have to throw it into the fires of Mount Doom and cast it into the fire so that it disappears. That is the only thing that we can do with that ring of power. Get rid of it. That is not a power that any human being can or should have and should wield. So once you start to deprogram people in one piece or another, and everyone will have their own thing, whatever that thing is, that needle that gets into their brain and starts to shatter things, that will be the magical thing that will, for them, will start to get them questioning the system as it exists. And that could be, as I say, absolutely anything that interests people. Maybe some people are particularly into health and being healthy, and they, for example, 10 years ago, it was perfectly valid. Even 15 years ago, it was perfectly valid, totally normal for, you know, trendy West Coast liberal hippies in California to question vaccines and big pharma and all of that. But now suddenly you are expected to 100% swallow anything big pharma says, anything they're trying to inject into your body. Well, at least some people might have difficulties tying that mental pretzel knot and might start to question and start to come and arrive at some of these startling conclusions. So again, there are many, many different paths that will lead. And so my position has always been, what can I do in this to inform others or to get people activated? All I can do is to talk about what I know and the things I've researched and the things I've come across. Hey guys, I found this, look at this. And I put it out there in my own way, saying it in the way that I do. And what else could I do? I can't pretend to be someone else. I can't put on some fake personality because people will see through that. I have to just simply authentically be me and put this information out there. Some people will love that. Some people will hate that. Many people will ignore it and never hear it, but that's just the way it is. But my position has always been, yeah, I'm going to do it my way, talking about the things I'm interested in the way that I do. And you should talk about the things you're interested in the way that you do. And other people who don't want to listen to me will want to listen to you. And other people who don't want to listen to either of us will want to listen to some other person who's putting it in a different way. That is my conception. This has to be a grassroots bottom up rather than top down movement. So I'm not going to give some list. Here's what you must talk about. No. Talk about what resonates with you. And that what you never know. That's the beauty of the ripple effect. You cast the pond in the stone and who knows how those ripples spread out and how they're going to affect someone far down the road. You'll never know, but you just have to be content in the knowledge that you can have an effect and you can alter at least someone's thinking out there sometime in the dead of night when they're thinking about what you said to them. Something will get into their brain and it'll start that process that sometime years down the road might flower in the revolution in consciousness. That's my envision of how this works.
Yeah, I think you're right, because there's different various, I mean, the government tries to control everything, right? So eventually you're going to run into something. Because I just had an interview about dog licenses in California, any state, I think. You have to get a rabies vaccine every year. And then to prove you got the vaccine, you got to pay the license. It's like a car or something. And it's, if you adopt the pet from the pound, you got to do that. So no more saving pets, I guess. I'm just kidding. But also like in COVID, I think you were mentioning how you got shocked about 9/11. That's how you kind of woke up. I think some people woke up during COVID, but I mean, is that, hopefully you're right. I think there's two ways people could like wake up by just being shocked and they do something terrible to you. And now you're questioning, like, was that just, did they do that? Is that good that they lied like 1,000 times? And some people can get educated by just watching some videos. And I mean, it's not like a super complicated topic we're talking about. We're not rocket scientists. Well, maybe you are, I don't know. But also people are talking about cancer and a metabolic therapy, which mm-hmm. is basically just don't stop eating high carbs from America, American mm-hmm. diet. And then the Ozempic stuff, they're like, hey, Ozempic's, you're not really fat because you eat a lot. It's just a genetic disease, so take this drug. And like people start to question, they're like, how is the state pushing this? And I mean, there's various aspects, food. I don't know much about it, but like they can question any aspect pretty much because the government's going to be involved. Yeah. So are we all just following the social contract theory? Do we deserve what we have today because everybody seems to just acquiesce, accept a fee, accept permits, taxes, and even work for government-backed / secure jobs?
I mean, right. What's that old phrase about you deserve the population deserves the government it gets or whatever that phrase is? Well, maybe you deserve the government you vote for, which is to say, if you participate in this process willingly and knowingly and help this monstrosity to exist, then as what was that old George Carlin bit? You say because I don't vote. I don't get a right to complain. No. It's exactly the opposite. You voted, so you don't get a right to complain because you participated in the process. You said, yes, I agree. Whoever gets 50% plus one gets to rule over the world. Oh, no, the wrong guy got in. Oh, well, we'll just have to vote harder next time. Whereas I, who did not participate in this process, does not consent, does not give over my identity to some mythical unicorn beast known as government. Nope, that has nothing to do with me or my life. Unfortunately, we live in a system where there are enough indoctrinated statist enforcers who will make sure come to the with a gun at your door if you don't pay your taxes. But I don't consent. I don't give myself, my identity over to this. So yes, I do have the right to complain. If you vote, you sure don't have the right to complain. You can complain, oh, you know, the vote was stolen. It was a rigged election. You participated in it, and your answer to that is to participate again, but do it harder next time. Don't worry, guys. If you vote harder, Trump will get in this time. I, at a certain point, like with so many things, like, again, for those trendy left coast liberals who were 100% against Big Pharma and vaccines and things 10 years ago, but now are 100% on board with them. At a certain point, I don't know what to say to that. If you can do that, try that mental pretzel knot. Okay, well, you are an NPC. But luckily, I think we have discovered that over the course of human history, yes, there are always NPCs, and they will go with whatever is the sort of the general climate, the zeitgeist. They will, okay. And it, exactly as, say, in the American Revolution, for whatever that did or did not accomplish, it really was led by a few percentage points of the population. The vast majority of people thought of themselves as British subjects until suddenly it was fashionable not to think that. And now, okay, now we're American in independence. Yay. Whatever's the winning team, whatever's happening, most people will just go along to get along. And you know what? I'm not even necessarily going to denigrate that because in my ideal world, I don't have to think about that. I don't have to devote my life to talking about what other people are doing and the machinations of some power elite. I just want to live my life. I want to go out and play with my children and do things in the real world. I just want to live my life. I don't want to think about this stuff. So I get why people just go along with whatever the sort of most people think this, so I'll think this. I get why people do that. Unfortunately, that's what leads us into tyranny, so we can't afford to do that. But yes, in the ideal world, we don't have to think about this and devote all of our time and attention and energy towards fighting against the New World Order or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. I mean, also the mental pretzels we're talking about, like people who voted for Trump and they're Republicans, right? That supposedly they're supposed to be anti during the pandemic, like anti-lockdown, pro-freedom, anti-vax. But who pushed the operation? Was it Warp Speed? Who signed it? Donald Trump. And he never really mentioned anything bad about the vaccine.
But he didn't mandate the vaccines. He said it was your free choice, so it's a good thing. Don't question it, Gilberto. Trump is your friend. Don't worry. He was misled by absolutely everyone around him, and he went along with it, but he won't next time if you just vote harder.
Again, what do you say to someone who does that? I don't know.
Just try to reach their children, maybe in 10 years or something. I don't know. I think some people do just die with their beliefs because they don't want to admit that they got tricked or they're wrong. Like, come on. But all right, my next question or statement first. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Some people choose to replace happiness with property. In the first paragraph of the Declaration, it mentions laws of nature and of nature's God. It, however, does say that humans have the right to start a new government when the old one becomes corrupt, but I'm sure you disagree with that. So what are human rights within the laws of nature, and what is the right of liberty in this context?
Right. Well, actually, just parenthetically, I don't necessarily disagree with the idea that people have the right to construct and set up some sort of government if they want. That's actually part of voluntarism, is if you want to create this system where you agree, I will be ruled over by 50% plus one, and whatever they say, we'll do, and we'll set it up exactly as it exists today. If you voluntarily choose to be a part of that, I wouldn't presume to be able to stop you or want to stop you. That's your free choice. I will just simply opt out. No, doesn't apply to me. So yes, people can set up a government if that's what they choose. But having said that, sorry, now I've forgotten what the actual question was.
Oh, what are the, because it mentions like our inalienable rights, liberty, and the laws of nature, nature's God. And
yes. I mean,
what are they talking about? Like, it's kind of philosophical.
Okay, yes. You point out, for example, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which was an invention by Jefferson. Actually, I toy with the idea that the Declaration was actually written by Thomas Paine, but that's a whole other conspiracy theory. Anyway, whoever wrote the Declaration, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, well, where does that come from? Because the original formulation in John Locke was life, liberty, and property. So how did it get changed, and what does that mean? And people talk about that. And then I did an entire editorial, I believe at the beginning of this year, right? What year are we in? Who even knows? About happiness and what that concept actually means. And of course, in our dumbed down age today, people interpret happiness to just mean, hey, I'm having fun playing a video game or something. That is not what was meant by happiness. Anyway, you can go read my editorial on that for more. But what is the point of this? There was an excellent video. What was it called? The Philosophy of Liberty. I believe it was called The Philosophy of Liberty, and I'm sure I could dig up the link to that. It was a stick figure animation. I mean, absolutely just the most basic animation kind of thing you've ever seen. Flash animation from like 2005 or something. I don't know when it was created. A long time ago. But I remember seeing that when I was in my process of tumbling down that rabbit hole, that really articulated in a very simple way that actually struck a chord with me. And I haven't re-watched it in a couple decades now, so I don't know what I'd think about it today. But it made that point that nobody has the right to, for example, take your life, murder, right? Nobody has the right to do that. Okay, so life. Nobody has the right to come and throw you in a cage for whatever, violating whatever arbitrary rule that they have decided. Liberty. They can't arbitrarily confine you. And nobody can come and take your stuff without asking. They can't steal from you. Property. Life, liberty, property. The three freedoms that underpin the society that we understand, right? And that we're working towards. And again, that animation was just so simple and straightforward. And it was really one of the first times I had heard that articulated in such a way, because growing up in the statist indoctrination system in Canada, it's all socialist programming from the time you're born, essentially. And it's all about that consequentialist utilitarian argument of the greatest good for the greatest number and blah, all that kind of stuff. So to hear that articulated, oh, these are fundamental rights that I have as a human being. And that's another thing that, again, unfortunately, in our dumbed down age, we start to lose the meanings of words so that they're easy to deny. For example, equality. All men are created equal. And
in our day and age, and given the type of context that we're living in and the debates that happen right now, unfortunately, that distinction between equality of opportunity and equality of outcome is being elided. So that people might hear that and think, what, not everyone's equal. Some people are, you know, great athletes. Some people are great thinkers. Some people are whatever. Everyone has different things. Yes, of course. Please do not fall down on the stupidest straw man hill here. That is not the argument that is being made. It is not about equality of people's personalities or attributes. It is not about equality of outcome. Everyone will become the same thing and everyone will have the same level of lifestyle, etc. No, it is about equality of opportunity. Fundamentally, you cannot come in and say, this human being does not have the right to life because I deem it so. I think this person isn't good enough to live in the human community. No, you are not the arbiter of that, and you don't have that kind of power. So we are all equal on the equal playing field, and then we all play out on that equal playing field, and whatever happens on that playing field happens. And so retribution for murder and things like that, again, becomes things to be adjudicated at the common law level. Now, having said all of that, yes, where does this ultimately leave us with that philosophy? The natural rights, the laws of nature and of nature's God. And I think that's the thing that will cover both the theists and the non-theists. As people probably by this point know, most of the founding fathers of the United States were deists who did not believe in God in the same way that probably your average American thinks and conceptualizes of God. It's more of like the Einsteinian notion of God, of just the, you know, the principles of the universe that we can discover through the laws of nature, and as in the laws of gravity and what have you. Well, that's the type of God that these people were thinking about. But again, so whether or not you are a devout Christian or whatever you believe in, and you think that that is the concept of God, or whether you think there's no, it's not like a floating man in the sky kind of, you know, basic level of again, dumbing things down so they're easy to deny. If you think that that's all a hocus pocus fairy tale, still, you can understand the concept of nature's God, as in this, the way that the universe is, just the rules of the universe that we know and can understand through our human reason. Where does reason come from? What is consciousness? Whatever. Piddly little details. At any rate, again, whatever you believe, you can understand that concept, laws of nature and of nature's God. That is the concept of natural law. And I think that is the bedrock. And discovering how natural law plays out in the real world, again, is a messy process that involves interpretation and adjudication. And the best way to do that is not to give all of that power to this one individual to adjudicate for everyone for all time. It is for that to be a process that accrues over time. And we start to discover things as we arrive at an intersubjective understanding that can change in different communities. And different communities will have different standards. Can people wrap their minds around that? I like to think they can.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we have to hope they can. I mean, otherwise it's just very pessimistic and nihilistic, or what is it? We did mention that, I mean, I think people, even nowadays, they don't want to talk about God. They just want to, they call it a higher power. I mean, they don't like the word God. So, I mean, but like you mentioned,
well, it can just be scientific. I understand why. And it's interesting because I get emails quite frequently saying, well, James, I know you're an atheist, but, and I always think, really? News to me? No, of course, I do believe. I don't believe that the universe just suddenly popped into existence out of nothing for no reason and just randomly self-assembled into human beings and all of this. No, I think there is obviously a God, but again, how do we define God? And unfortunately, again, in this age of dumbing everything down to the simplest thing, it's either like the floating man in the sky conception, which is the straw man that's easily thrown out by the rationalists of our day and age, or, oh no, maybe it's a divine ordering principle that has something to do with the universe as we understand it, as it is unfolding. Maybe there's something that's so incredibly difficult to understand and articulate that you can't come up with God is X, dot, period, done. Okay, moving on to the next subject. Maybe this is something that we have to devote our entire lives, in fact, not just our lives, but the lives of multiple human beings over many, many, many generations, trying to articulate different dimensions of what this is and what it means to have a highest good and what, how do we achieve that? And what is this, what is the progress towards that like? And all of these bajillion aspects that get embedded into this single word, God, I understand why people have problems using it, because it is, it's for many people, I'm sure, so ineffable or so easily dismissible, because they rule it, they bring it back down to that God is the man floating in the clouds. You're a stupid fairy tale believer if you believe that. Again, I lament at the ability of some people to dismiss some of the most fundamental aspects of the fabric of our lives and of the universe and our meaning and our place in the world so easily. And I think that that is unfortunately a product of the incredible dumbing down of our society in every single aspect. And unfortunately, I say this advisedly as someone who's been doing this now for a full-time living for 14 years, and I've been doing it online for 17 years. I think that online discourse is truly adding to that dumbing down. It is accelerating that dumbing down to the point where people are having difficulty. Even myself, I note, I read less than I used to, say, 17 years ago, 20 years ago. I read less. I suppose I maybe in volume I read the same or even more, but I'm reading ephemera online, little newsfeed nuggets and disconnected what have you, sitting down and reading a book cover to cover. Who's got time for that anymore? I just want to hear some people talking about this on a podcast. So much easier, right? And unfortunately, I think that is the process of dumbing down the discussion so that we never move past the stuck on stupid basics of, you know, arguing about God is a floating man in the sky. And if you believe in it, you're stupid. It's difficult to get beyond that when we're limited to this online discourse. Even this, even an hour long conversation between two people who are really trying to delve into it, even that is becoming too much for most people. Oh my God, just make a 2-minute TikTok. James, can't you just make 2-minute TikToks about all the things you talk about? Yeah, I guess I could, but that wouldn't be me. And so I'm not going to do it. Again, I'm going to do things in my way, the way that comes to me. And you can either like it or not. That's your decision.
Right, right. So I think we talked for about an hour. How much more is that?
I got a few more minutes, but if we can wrap it up, that would be awesome.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, I was just going to mention the Christians in America and how they cite Bible verses that let everybody be subject to the ruling authorities, for their powers are instituted, established, / given by God, such as in Romans 13-1 or John 19:11. What can you say about this? I mean, probably already offended them with everything we said.
Right. Well, okay. If we're citing the Bible, then why don't we cite? And unfortunately, I'm not going to have the citation off the top of my head, but I know it exists in the Old Testament where the Jews are asking for a king. They want a ruler. And God is telling them, no, you don't want a king. You don't want a ruler. That's not going to work out well for you. No, we want a king. Okay, here you go, guys. And everything that results from that horrible decision. So why don't we cite that? As, you know, actually, God doesn't want you to be ruled over by some special human being who says that he has the right to rule over you. You know, again, it's with so many of these passages, pick and choose the one that you like. Anyway, Romans 13, written presumably by Paul in a certain context in the Roman Empire and what you can and cannot say. And there are the people who say, well, actually, no, he was being super, super subversive in a way that allowed him to more or less dodge the Roman authorities, at least until he eventually got killed, because he would say things about Jesus Christ is Lord and all of these things which were encoded in the lexicon of the time. You're only allowed to say these things about Augustus. You know, you can only say these things about Caesar. You can't say that. And all of the things that he was saying about Jesus are the things that people were saying about Caesar. So you would understand if you could read between the lines, he was being deeply subversive, but he wouldn't come out and say that. Anyway, you can go the whole political analysis route of the Bible and the things that are written in it and how it was constructed. But as I say, you could cite other passages that show, hey, maybe God was an anarchist.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to mention, like, when Jesus is on his in the forest or the desert for like 40 days and Satan tempts him and Satan says, I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world, for they are given to me by, I guess, God or whoever, the kingdoms being like the ruling kingdoms and everything. So, I mean, and also, like you mentioned earlier, we could just have everybody just try to seek the highest common good and objectively and through observing it, I guess. So yeah, unless you have any other things to say, any closing statement?
I think we have covered an awful lot, but thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about these things. They're foundationally incredibly important. And at a time when everyone else is talking about the selection in the United States and expecting me as a Canadian in Japan to be as excited as they are about that. Oh, by the way, I'm also a voluntarist. I don't care about your stupid selection, but I don't know. It's refreshing to have a conversation like this one. So thank you.
Yeah, well, people were telling me, like, did you watch the debate? The debate. I'm like, what the heck? No.
All right. No, but I heard the remix of that guy who did that song about they're eating the cats, they're eating the dogs. Yeah, that was funny.
It just shows you how funny the whole thing is. All right. Well, thank you, James. I appreciate it. I know you're the one to talk to about these things. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
All right. How are we going?
Yep. Bye-bye.
Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Are you ready?
Hey, you think you could tell us what to do? You think you could tell us what to wear? You think that you're better? Well, you better get ready. Bow to the masters. Break it down! Tell me what to do. You know who you're talking to. But you better get used to the way the war bounces. I see what you got in measures and ounces. But that's a break, boy. Yeah, that's a break, little man. Break it down. Big man, I'll treat you like you're a little man.
I came to realize the obviousness of the truth. What is the Matrix? Control. The Matrix is a computer-generated dream world built to keep us under control in order to change a human being into this.
No. I don't believe it. It's not possible.
I didn't say it would be easy, Neo. I just said it would be the truth.
Stop! Let me out! Let me out! I want out!
Easy, Neo. Easy.
Get this thing.